Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. To drive between North Bend and Easton, it's going to be a lot smoother this winter. The state has just wrapped up 10 years worth of work east of Snoqualmie Pass, and Chris has a look at the progress of the project.
All right. There really is no such thing as a construction season anymore. We've kind of talked about that for the last couple of years, that they do as much work as they can whenever they can. However, the seasons still do exist across the mountain passes. They just can't get work done when it starts snowing. The Washington Department of Transportation has now shut down its construction projects on the I-90 corridor for the winter.
We are based on seasons, so once we get to November, we usually shut down any construction that we have left because of the snow that is coming, because we get about 30 feet of snow on Snoqualmie Pass, which pretty much prevents us from doing anything in the winter.
The state's Megan Lott says they're shutting down after reaching a major milestone on the expansion and safety project east of Snoqualmie Pass. The first 7 miles of the 15-mile expansion to Easton is officially over. It's taken about a decade to move the freeway away from the cliffs so the avalanches don't close the roadway as often. They built the first wildlife bridge over I-90, and the widening of the entire freeway is now complete.
Drivers in both directions of traffic have 3 lanes going west, 3 lanes going east. They're much wider. We also have wider chain up and chain off areas with a lot more illumination or lighting.
And of course, it takes 10 years to do this, or roughly, because they only get to work about 6 months out of the year. So it's really 5 years worth of work that's taken close to a decade. And Lott knows it's been a pain for drivers during construction.
It's a major undertaking, and we know it's taken a long time, but now we're glad that drivers can actually enjoy the benefits of this first section.
The construction on the next 8 miles, all the way over to Easton, was supposed to start next summer. But Lott says that has hit a snag now. That project has been put on hold by Governor Inslee because of I-976.
It's a huge project. It benefits our state because I-90 is the main east-west transportation corridor. So again, we really want to try and get this remaining section finished. But again, we're kind of in this holding pattern until we hear more.
All right. So that's kind of gives you an update on what they've been doing east of the mountain. West of Snoqualmie Pass, the state has made a ton of progress as well between North Bend and Snoqualmie Pass. As you know, and I chronicled when I tried to drive over to the other side of the state during the summer on a Friday afternoon and hit all the construction and the lane closures and the bridge closures, there's been a lot of pain over the summer. Contractors replaced more than 2,200 concrete panels. They've repaired 4 bridge decks so far this year. And Lott says drivers need to watch out for just slightly different road conditions now.
Drivers may kind of notice some grooving in that pavement, which might pull your car to one side or the other of the lane. That's just because of the type of grinding machines that we use, and that will eventually wear down.
The final concrete repair from North Bend to the summit will finish up next year. And by the way, the paving from Ellensburg to Vantage is now officially complete. So they've gotten a lot of work done this year on the I-90 corridor.
If it turns out that because of I-976, they can't continue the project, would you consider that to be a major bottleneck or just an inconvenience?
Well, it's one of those things where they want to add an extra, widen all the way to Easton, which would help ease things. It's one of those things where that project is going to get done. It's just they're trying to figure out where it falls on the priority list. And I think it would be kind of near the top considering how much freight goes across I-90 there. So I would just consider it kind of a hiccup right now because they haven't started anything. There aren't any lane closures or whatnot. They hadn't gone out to bid yet. So the project needs to get done. But right now, I think we got 7 miles done. If it was delayed a little bit, I think they could be okay.
The former Boeing manager who warned back in 2018 that Boeing's Renton plant was producing defective 737 Maxes testified before Congress yesterday. It was lost in all the impeachment coverage, but his name is Ed Pearson, and he said his warnings were mostly ignored by Boeing and federal regulators, even after the first and second 737 MAX crashes. His job before he decided to retire was to oversee final assembly, and when production was being ramped up at Renton in early 2018, he didn't like what he was overseeing. Parts were being delivered late, prompting the company to try to speed up the assembly process.
On June 9th, 2018, while the Lion Air airplane was being produced 4 months before it crashed, I wrote an email to the 737 general manager advising him to shut down the production line to allow our team time to regroup so we could safely finish the planes. Following that email, I requested a one-on-one meeting with the general manager on July 18th and repeated my recommendation to shut down the factory for a brief period of time. When I mention that I've seen operations in the military shut down for lesser safety concerns, I will never forget his response, which was, the military isn't a profit-making organization. During this time frame, 737 factory was in chaos. Every single factory health metric was getting record low marks, and each one was trending in the wrong direction.
He says both of the planes that crashed were built at Renton during the period when employees were under a lot of pressure to speed things up.
In 30 years in the military, I never saw that level of schedule pressure being put on people. And, you know, when you put people in that kind of pressure and they're tired, mistakes are made.
Pearson said all the attention so far has been on the MAX software, but he says a software fix isn't enough. He wants a thorough inspection of the sensors that are suspected of sending the faulty data in the first place.
Both Boeing and the FAA knew in December 2018 that the original angle of attack sensor on the Lion Air airplane had failed, which is clearly a production issue since the airplane was brand new. Although the defective Boeing installed sensor was replaced with a Lion Air installed part before the crash, that does not explain why the Boeing part failed in the first place.
Pearson testified that to this day, no one has asked why two brand new angle of attack sensors on two brand new planes, inspected, installed, and tested by Boeing at the Renton plant during the summer of 2018, failed. As he kept trying to get the attention of company officials, he was assured that all the planes had received thorough inspections, but he says he personally found 13 safety incidents that occurred on 737 MAX aircraft within months of being put into service, representing 4% of the MAX aircraft that were flying at the time. He says no one has investigated whether the hundreds of other planes manufactured during the summer of 2018 at Renton, including the currently flying 737 next-gen airplanes and P-8 military airplanes, might have faulty sensors or other production quality issues.
There have been 13 other safety incidents involving faulty hardware or other systems, many of which were serious. Any one of these circumstances alone should justify an investigation of production. And together, they amount to an open and shut case for such an investigation. The bottom line is the 737 factory needs to be thoroughly investigated and closely monitored by regulatory authorities, specifically the FAA, on a continuous basis into the future.
Which leads to the big question, which was asked by Congressman Albio Sires of New Jersey.
Has anything changed?
That's a great question. Again, I'm really encouraged. The FAA is going to go in and do a thorough investigation, talk to employees. I'd start with the employees that are actually building the plane, you know, the people that are the mechanics and the electricians and the engineer, you know, the quality inspectors. And those are the people who are going to give the best perspective overall of how things are going. And looking at all the data and the production reports, there's a lot to look at. I am encouraged by that, though, that they're committed to doing that.
So you're encouraged by what Mr. Dixon said this morning, that he's going to follow up on this?
I'm encouraged that they're going to do it. I'm a healthy skeptic right now, Congressman.
It's a reference to Stephen Dixon, head of the FAA. And Chris, I read through his opening statement. It was pretty devastating, especially considering he came forward before the crashes happened.
Yeah, and if we kind of, just to reset history a little bit, just to remind everybody, and I mean, the people in Renton know this, you know, infinitely, but they were pushing production and ramping up to that 45, 50 number of planes, three sevens a month. And they were having part shortages, engine shortages. The supply chain could not keep up with the ramp up in production. And so they were building planes without some things and then going out, they'd have to re-engineer them and take them apart and then put them back together.
Yeah,
because the suppliers just couldn't keep up. And this kind of hits with that similar time frame when they were having such explosive growth, but the rest of the industry could not keep up with them. So those time frames kind of coincide a little bit, and it makes you wonder a little bit, you know, were the supply chain so under such pressure to get so many things in there that maybe they were cutting corners and there were things in the supply chain that that led to some of this?
He seemed to imply that there are hundreds of planes that need to be rechecked. I mean, that would be a huge jump.
That's what it sounds like. I mean, and again, as you mentioned, not just the MAX. I mean, we're talking about the NGs in there, the 700s, the 800s, or the 900s there that you know, they're used for the P-8 Subhunter matter of fact, the first one just went to the UK or a couple months ago, the Subhunter there. So, yeah, they've got a lot to look at. And, that would be a tremendous undertaking to have to do that.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now is Washington State Representative, District 6, Derek Kilmer. One of the things you've been working on is a bill to protect shorelines. I'll just quote from the Bloomberg story here. The bill that was passed in the House provides more money to protect coasts from the consequences of climate change, including hundreds of millions of dollars to promote living shorelines and combat coastal erosion, which sounds to me like it's too late to prevent this from happening, and it's just time to prepare. Is that what's going on?
Well, I don't think it's too late to combat climate change. I think, obviously, as we've talked about before, climate change is real, and it requires big, bold action. But listen, Dave, we know in our region there are already folks who are seeing the impacts of climate change. I represent 11 Native American tribes, 4 are coastal tribes, that are in the process of trying to move to higher ground. You know, I visited and I brought the chair and ranking member of the Appropriations Committee. We went to Tahola, the lower village of the Quinault Indian Nation. Their tribal president, Fawn Sharp, said, you know, when I was a kid, the ocean was a football field's length away from our village. She said, now it's our front porch. And when they have severe storms or when their seawall breaches, I mean, when I spoke in support of the bill, and there was a component of this bill that passed that was something I've been working on now for years, which is to provide direct support to tribal communities that live on the coast and are having to deal with these issues. I brought a photo of a man in a canoe, and he wasn't canoeing on a lake, and he wasn't canoeing on a river. He was canoeing through the streets of his village because the village had flooded out. And that is unfortunately a far too common occurrence, and that's what this bill was about, trying to provide support to coastal communities that really need it. You know, I could say the same, you know, I was out in La Push, and if you go visit the tribal school in La Push where they care for little kids, you know, you or I could stand right outside that school and throw a rock and land it in the ocean. And so they're really in harm's way. The Ho tribe and the Macaw tribes are also seeing real threats to public safety and public access and to their cultural landmarks. And so that's what this bill was about. It was a package of 10 bills all dealing with coastal issues. One of those bills was the Tribal Coastal Resiliency Act, which acknowledges tribal sovereignty and acknowledges the real threat that tribes are facing and provides them access to some help from the federal government.
Okay, does this mean then that it's going to be the federal government's policy that threatened coastal areas are going to get money to do whatever they need to survive? And will that apply just to tribal communities or, you know, will people with beach houses on coastlines be able to go to the federal government and get help either raising their houses or buying their houses? Or how far does this go?
Yeah, the bill, and as I said, there's 10 different bills. A number of them dealt with an existing federal program called the Coastal Zone Management Grant Program, which is funding to help coastal communities that are dealing with the challenges of being on a coast. We have communities throughout our region who have been able to benefit from that. The tribal component of this is right now, tribes are not able to directly access those funds. If they have a real threat, like the tribes I mentioned, they have to go hat in hand to the state of Washington to try to get prioritized by the state, then the state has to pursue funding. So there's no direct access. That's both a problem from the standpoint of failing to recognize tribal sovereignty, and it fails to recognize the very significant threat that tribes face. And so I think that's why you saw bipartisan support for this. This was a bill that made it out of the Natural Resources Committee unanimously, and this package of bills got broad bipartisan support yesterday, and I'm hopeful that as a consequence of that, we'll see it move in the Senate, become law, and start helping people in our region.
I'm thinking of the map that King County recently issued. There are large numbers of people who have properties that are near beaches or coastlines, and that shows the various climate change scenarios. But in most of them, those houses nearest the beach are gone. Maybe not next year, but in 50 years. And I'm just wondering, are we moving towards the federal government picking up the responsibility for making those property owners whole?
The federal government plays a role in that really in two ways right now. One, through the federal flood insurance program, which we all as taxpayers do contribute to, in part because insurance is based on risk. And if you are a waterfront property owner, you face very high risk to the point where, you know, you have some communities in Aberdeen and Hoquiam where the flood insurance would cost more than the mortgage. And so, as a consequence of that, there is a federally backed flood insurance program that we all as taxpayers and as citizens contribute to. And the other way is through these coastal zone management grants, which from a broad community standpoint, that's assistance to help with things like persistent flooding, tsunami threat, which obviously in our region there's a legitimate concern about, and trying to ensure that there's adequate planning and mitigation to try to prevent potential loss of life and in the case of this tribe's potential loss of cultural resources.
Sixth District Congressman Derek Kilmer. Congressman, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Always good to talk to you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. We've heard this story before. A man dying from cancer requests Christmas cards to help him cope. Hundreds, sometimes thousands of cards pour in, wish granted. But this particular case of generosity and kindness is different. Milwaukee's Gene Wittenhiller is that dying man. He also received hundreds of Christmas cards.
An overwhelming outpouring of love and support from people that I've never met, probably never will.
And he was right to guess probably never will, because three young men went out of their way to get their Christmas cards to Gene. WITI-TV says two brothers and a cousin saw the Facebook post requesting the cards and started talking.
I was just like, how can I make this man day better? How can I make him smile?
We used everything we had in our pockets to put in the gas tank, to buy the Christmas cards.
They drove 2.5 hours from where they live to where Gene lives and knocked on the door.
He teared up because we were the only people that came to actually see him. He got a lot of letters in the mail, but we were the only people who actually showed up at his doorstep.
It made me look at my life so different. I learned so much.
Their cards to Gene had a simple message.
From the bottom of my heart and all the way from Milwaukee, we want to bring you prayers and let you know that we care.
But the impact of seeing Gene, well, that's a feeling no words could ever express.
It was the best decision we ever made. It was so beautiful. It was so amazing.
And I have Gene's address. I'll put it on my Twitter feed if you'd like to send him a card, too. You can find me at Colleen Cairo FM.
Time for our Sports Insider from Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Here is Stacy Rost. And we have the cheat sheet for the path to the playoffs. So which one of these scenarios do you think is most likely to happen? I'm seeing number one here is Seattle wins, the Rams lose or tie, and we're in. That's all it would take?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the Seahawks kind of switch spots with the 49ers from last week. So because the Seahawks had the tiebreaker over the 49ers and they had the same record, the Seahawks could have gotten into the playoffs with only a win. It was all they needed. They didn't need any other team to do anything. The 49ers, even though they had the same record, they needed a win, plus they needed the Seahawks to beat the Rams. So neither team clinched a playoff spot because the Seahawks lost. So this week they kind of switched where suddenly the Seahawks need another team to do something. So it's still a fairly easy path to the playoffs, because you're depending on a good team to beat a bad team. But I mean, you never know. But I think that I would say the chances of the Seahawks clinching a spot this weekend are good.
What other team is headed to the playoffs, and who's our competition if we get there?
Right now, the only team that's clinched a spot is the New Orleans Saints. They're really good. I mean, you lost to them earlier this week. The teams looking at playoff spots are the Green Bay Packers, San Francisco 49ers, obviously.
Ooh.
I know. Seahawks. The Vikings have that kind of extra wild card spot right behind you. So you want them. You have the tiebreaker over them because you beat them. But the more the Vikings and the Ram lose, the better for you, because they're the two closest to kind of getting that extra playoff spot. The NFC East, which is that extra seed, it's going to be number four, is kind of a mess, because the team that gets in there will probably have a losing record, or at the very best be like an 8-8 yeah. team. But that's really just kind of like a race to the bottom of the division for them.
It doesn't seem fair
right?
that you get to go to the playoffs with a lousy record like that. So, all right. So we have what, 3 games left?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So you've got
so for sure
Panthers this weekend,
the Hawks have to win at least one of those 3 games, right?
Yes, you have to win at least one.
And then you have to have at least L.A., Minnesota, or Green Bay have to lose one.
For this weekend, yes. I mean, if you win one this weekend and say San Francisco loses or Green Bay loses, then next weekend you probably only need to win one again. So you're so close to getting a playoff spot that really just every single week you'll have a chance to just win and be in.
By the way, do the players do this kind of gamesmanship, looking at the playoffs, or do they just play a game by game, as Pete Carroll seems to love to say?
Yeah, that's really Pete Carroll's approach. But I think they also, Pete Carroll said something interesting. They have this thing called Tell the Truth Monday.
Yeah.
And normally it's like always about just looking at what you did in that previous game. But Pete Carroll mentioned to Dory something about, well, we have to be honest about where we are. So I think part of it is them saying we are so close to being in. So they're aware of it. They probably just don't focus on it the way that we do.
How has the team shuffled, if at all, now that Rashad Penny is going to be out?
Well, the first thing they did actually concerned a cornerback that they put on IR. So they activated Ryan Neal, who's a cornerback from the practice roster, and he'll mostly play on special teams. And then because they didn't have any running backs on the practice squad, they signed this guy named Xavier Turner, who has one of the craziest kind of preseason stories that I heard about earlier this year.
What is it?
It's well, it was really just like he was the story to me of every player's kind of preseason journey that is someone just trying to make the roster or what you would call a bubble player. So he joined the Cardinals as an undrafted free agent out of this tiny school in Texas, was cut by them, went to work out for three other teams, was on a plane at like midnight heading back to his home in Austin and got a call from the Seahawks, who he'd never worked out with before. And they were like, hey, can you get on the first flight out and come work out for us? Because they had three injuries at running back and the preseason opener was that Thursday, I think. And so he turns around, gets on like a 6 a.m. flight and heads back out to Seattle, works out with the team, signs with the team that day, has like a couple hours to learn the playbook, ends up being the leading rusher in that game. He has 42 yards on 13 carries with a couple like pretty impressive runs. And then in the locker room afterward, Pete Carroll introduces him to the team.
Wow.
So the whole thing was just this whirlwind for him.
So this is his star is born moment, huh?
Well, I mean, this is definitely the chance that all of those kinds of players who are working for roster spots hope about, which is that you make enough of an impact on a team that they bring you back when they inevitably have an injury, and then you kind of get your chance.
Yep. Stacey Ross, thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
There are other things happening besides impeachment. We are still fighting a war in Afghanistan. And the big question is, why? The Washington Post, after working really hard, has pried loose a huge number of documents, which they've dubbed the Afghanistan Papers, because they're a lot like the Pentagon Papers. They show that we've been lied to and that a tremendous amount of money and, alas, lives have been wasted. Let's go to CBS military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, what is your big takeaway from these documents?
So, Dave, I looked and talked with other people that have been in the Afghan community that have served over there, and I wanted to get their take first. And there's another side to this story. I think there's no question that the author paints a very negative picture. He picks and chooses certain things, but it's difficult to describe the 18 years that we've been there in kind of a broad brush. And I think we've got to differentiate between Americans being lied to and us failing and leaders not really caring enough to get it right or to say things that was going on. At 50,000 feet, the mission of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan is this: prevent another 9/11. And they can always kind of fall back to that. It's just that all of the multiple millions of subtasks that go along with that at this point now, what the costs have been, are now coming under question.
Well, what is the total cost now?
Oh, I think $1.5 trillion is what they're saying. And you think about it, the first 6 years of us being there, the mission was purely counterinsurgency. counterterrorism. We didn't do any nation building. We started that late in the Bush administration, and then Barack Obama embraced that mission completely, surges troops there, but then decides, you know, pretty much halfway we're going to withdraw them. And then we get back to, you know, kind of where we were there. But the amount of money we could have used and resources that have been into this have been tremendous. And we can cavil over whether or not it's been worth preventing another 9/11. But I'm afraid that if we do leave now at this point, we're just going to get back to where we were in 1999, pre-9/11, at with those same conditions.
On the nation building thing, as you point out, Barack Obama tried to ramp it up. I mean, George Bush was famous for saying that democracy is always better. We're going to plant seeds of democracy everywhere. But there were warning signs that that wasn't working, right? Why did Obama continue to do this when it was clear that we, and this is what the papers say, we knew nothing about the Afghan culture. We had no idea. And what we did know is that they didn't want somebody from the outside trying to recreate, you know, a mini U.S. on their territory.
Well, I mean, whether he was right or wrong, Barack Obama's instinct was always Iraq with the bad war, Afghanistan the good war. And that's why he was going to support it. The cognitive dissonance allowed him to be talked into it by guys like General McChrystal, talked into surging more troops. You know, two inherent tasks in Afghanistan. The first thing is take a poor country, try to make it rich, and then also take a violent country and try to make it safe. And how do you do those both at the same time? Just, you know, prove problematic. And you do one without the other, you're not going to get anything done.
So at this point, as you point out, we're there and history is history. What's our job now then? I mean, we've given up on nation building, right?
Right. So you look at this president who doesn't understand, let's call it what it is. He doesn't really understand the history of how we got there. All he wants to know is what's it cost? What are we doing there for? He wanted to bring all the troops out right away. The military industrial complex practically threw up over themselves over that. So I think you'll see him bring this down to 5,000 troops. We'll stay there for another 5 years. They'll become fundamentally like a trip net, let's say, like we have troops in other places. But you'll likely see, once we're out of there, a scene in 1975 with, you know, helicopters on top of embassies. Afghanistan is very much like Vietnam, just without the body counts and about all that went into that that conflict.
Is any other major nation going to take a swing at running Afghanistan?
No, I don't think so. We're not going to get the cooperation from Pakistan that we thought, because in their mind, and the current environment in Afghanistan is an existential threat to Pakistan. Pakistan wants the Taliban back in power because they want a nasty neighbor to the north that borders India, because India is their existential enemy. So that's why we never got contributions for them from the beginning. So again, you tie it all together. Afghanistan once again proves the places where kingdoms and empires go to the graveyard.
Yep.
It's lucky it didn't cost us, but it has cost us some from the American psyche.
So we'll be back to essentially patrolling, I assume, with spy satellites and drones and maybe some human sources on the ground to make sure that no second 9/11 is hatched there.
That's right. I think we're back to using our technology to contain anything inside of there, the human rights and all of those inside of Afghanistan, those will all be gone. We can't worry about how that country's run. But now this time, when we see videos of, you know, guys on monkey bars training to destroy Americans, we'll go ahead and launch satellites, or we'll launch the cruise missiles into them. We won't ask for permission. We'll just violate that sovereignty, and we'll just go ahead and take them out.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here to explain hangriness is Rachel Bell. So hangriness, I just thought that was just a more intense form of hungry, but it turns out there is supposed to be an anger component to hunger.
Yes. I think this is one of those New York Times articles that is just, you know, looking for something to do a story on, because, yeah, hangry is hungry and angry. And it is proven, I read some other articles, it is proven that people do get irritable when they are very hungry, or certain people get irritable. But a lot of people like to kind of put a lot more weight on it and just say, like, if I don't eat, I turn into a monster. And so this New York Times article says there are different degrees of angry, and being hangry doesn't touch on a lot of these degrees of anger. So they did a bunch of studies, and it took a while for people to study this because there are these moral and ethical things you must go through to do a study. And they said, said, we don't know how we feel about starving people just to see if they get a little mad. But then they decided, that'll be okay. So one of the studies they did was they had, 600 people in a cafeteria. Half of them had eaten. The other half were very, very hungry. And what they did was the people participating didn't know this was going to happen. They had people coming up to them saying, I'm sorry, could I, please have some money or could I have some food? And the participants were actually given food and money beforehand. And so they found that they gave just as generously when they were hungry mm-hmm. as the people who were not hungry.
Therefore, there's no such thing as hangriness.
I don't really see the connection. I don't know. Yeah. The whole article is basically saying that, no matter how hungry we get, people continue to be able to share with others and very pro-social. But I don't think that has to do with feeling irritable. You could still be charitable and giving and still be in a bad mood.
Yeah, I guess the whole point was to find out whether hunger does in fact make you truly angry enough to be stingy to someone.
Yeah.
Where do you think why would they even have that feeling that they felt it was something to be tested, that it was even a thing? I mean, do you find yourself getting angry when you're sitting at a restaurant, for example, and the food is slow?
I think that's different, though, because that's not because I'm hungry. It's because I'm just annoyed on principle
yes.
with the service.
See, that's
I rarely am hungry because I'm a privileged person who very much loves food, and I usually end up snacking before I get hungry. So I don't get hangry or hungry.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly felt that feeling at restaurants when you sit down and you're looking at your watch and the menu hasn't come yet. And usually when I go to a restaurant, I've got a show to go to afterwards, and so there's sort of a time constraint.
Yeah.
So and I get antsy. I wouldn't consider myself hangry so much as anxious.
Not Did very you... understanding.
I know. Did you forget that I am here? I got a show to go to.
It's funny you say that because I actually talked about this with my therapist yesterday
really?
About how I think there are other things that are going on when you're annoyed by that. Yes, if you have someplace to go, that makes sense. But I find myself being annoyed, I ordered my drink 10 minutes ago. Where is it? And then I realize, I'm not really that thirsty or I'm not really that hungry. What is it? And it all kind of comes back to being Buddhist and Zen and just being in the moment and not worrying about all these other circumstances right. and not letting little things bother you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you're having a good conversation, the time goes by much faster.
Exactly.
So many times that's a symptom of, you don't have the right dining partner or you just ran out of things to say.
It's funny because we talked about that too. Maybe I should just start live streaming my therapy sessions.
Maybe I should just sit in with you.
I think that's actually what's been missing in my therapy is a Dave Ross figure.
That's it.
Yeah.
Actually, by the way, have you asked her this yet? Because
I'm cured.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome. I'm going to go back to eating at my desk, not being hangry.
And there she goes. Nobody here
loses
their temper because of hunger, because we don't get to eat at all in the morning.
No, have you ever noticed? I'm constantly snacking.
Are you really?
I will run you over with a car to get food these days. As a breastfeeding mother, I can't eat enough.
Is that why you leave during the commercials? You're out there
to eat constantly. You should look at my desk. Open the drawer. I've got food everywhere.
I believe that would be crossing a boundary.
To open my desk drawer?
Yes.
I give you permission, Dave. If you're ever hungry, which I never see you eat, by the way. I've seen you nibble an apple. I take
yes.
that back.
No, I have. Sometimes I have a carrot in the morning.
Yes.
Just to have something to do on the drive.
That's it. Since every once in a while, I'll wave a donut under your nose.
Since I can't play with my cell phone on the way to work, I have to eat a carrot. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.